Okay. I think librarians' quiz is a rather good idea, but, and there should be a prize, of course. But we'll come to that later. The final lecture in your unit today will be on Lawrence Buell. And if I can start by taking you quickly back to the core ideas that we've discussed so far. We've read a wonderful novel about growing up in London at a particular point in history. And then we've had two sessions where we've reflected on the core issues of the relationship between individuals, communities, histories, and cultures. One of the things that both Williams and Frederick Jameson has had in common, for instance, was the assumption of what we might call the materiality of culture, that culture is a lived system and textual analysis takes place in the context of that lived system, for example. Both of them meditated on the relationship between culture and particular moments of history, and in a way, implicit in their argument, linked to that idea of culture being a lived system, had been an emphasis placed on the place where from where cultural systems and upon which history, the whole network of what we call history, arises from and takes place. So today we hone in on that final element on our in this particular unit, the importance of, you know, when we talk about materiality of culture, lived system, et cetera, what remains implicit or an assumption that remains implicit in that discussion is where that culture or that particular history is grounded. Where is it happening? Does the fact, for example, that McInnes's novel is grounded in London, the space of London, at a particular time, say late 1950s, is that space of London important or not? Could it have been written about anywhere else, for example? Would it have been written differently if it was written about anywhere else, et cetera, et cetera? In other words, what had remained implicit, think of those discussions that Williams had about the country and the city, although those were important categories for Williams to think about certain kinds of histories and, most importantly, certain kinds of styles of literature. We didn't really engage at any length with the idea of the place from where the culture and history emanates. So today, Buell is in a way, if you think of him as a corrective to that slight lack of attention placed on the specificity of the grounds of culture, that is where Buell is coming in from. He accepts the notion of the importance of culture. He accepts the importance of the notion of history. He accepts the notion that these things are intricately linked to each other and they produce each other. But he wants to emphasize that third category there, place, if you want, the ground from where culture emanates or is produced from. So today we look at the importance of how do we think about the ground, the space, the material space, and what is the relationship between that and literary and cultural styles? Can we talk about, for example, I'm sure if I asked you to do, I don't know, write a poetry now in this particular place, space, you would all come up with wonderfully gothic and dark ideas and about how, you know, murderous this space is, how dark and depressive it is, how it makes you to machete me, and et cetera, all those ideas. So in other words, what is the concrete idea, or what is the concrete links between the space you inhabit and your cultural output and your specific histories? That is what really, what we're going to, or what Buell talks about today. So those two terms we have already looked at some details, culture and history, will emphasize on space. Now, Buell's starting proposition is we have been insufficient or negligent, slightly, as cultural and literary practitioners to think about the specific relationship between space and cultural styles. Most often, this is your second quotation in your handout, it can be said, he says, of all genres, that is to say all styles of writing and all styles of cultural outputs, that place is something authors find easier to name and praise than to present. So, Place is something, Buell alleges, is incessantly present in everything that you read about, that you look at, that you hear, etc., etc. In other words, all forms of cultural activities have place, a sense of place in them. But, he says, so far, hitherto, authors have found it easier to name and praise a particular setting rather than to present them properly. Okay, so for example, we have read McKinney's, we have read Absolute Beginners, and this is a photograph of late 1950s of the kind of place in London, Napoli, that our narrator would hang out in. Now, these places are present. This is obviously taken at a time very early in the morning when nobody's out and about. Knowing Napoli, they've probably partied really hard and are still sleeping off the effects of beers and drugs. But that is the space that the novel, for example, presents us through prose. Now, Buell's idea or contention is that authors are good at doing so. They're good at giving you a sense, or in fact, it's inescapable. This idea of a particular place and the use of that place, but they find it difficult to present it in all its specificity. Now, I want us to think about what he means by that. Clearly, all of you have read poems, novels, short stories, whatever, seen films, where place is very important. They're there all the time, whether it's it's a city, whether it's a village, whether it's, I don't know, the space. It is there where characters that you look at, human and otherwise, inhabit. So what does Buell mean when he says they haven't been presented or authors find it difficult to present space or place properly? What is the notion of the proper? Surely here you have a presentation of a space. Okay, it's a visual presentation. In what sense is that not really proper when we move to writing, when we move to written space or textual space? Why is this particular category not sufficient? That is what Buell is asking us to think about. So the first thing to think about is that space permeates, the idea of ground, of space, permeates all kind of writing and cultural production. But Buell is saying they have been insufficiently represented. It's not a matter of quantity. They are there everywhere. It's a matter of the quality and the way in which they're written about. And Buell wants us to be more attentive to the special, specific properties of non-human spaces. The places, for example, that we see or we automatically assume as the background on which a story or against which a story is told. So, again, going back to Absolute Beginners, when we read the novel, quite normally, our impression is this is a novel, it's a coming-of-age novel about this quite feisty teenager at a particular time in London. Now, London there operates as a backdrop that brings out all the excitement, the contradictions, the pains, etc., that this character goes through. In other words, it very much exists, but it exists as a background against which a human story is told. Okay, so that's a very common experience in a novel or in a film, where our main attention really is focused on the human drama. In other words, if we think of culture as being specifically human, that is what takes precedence over and beyond the space against which within which those characters operate. This is perfectly normal, obviously. We are really interested in what happens to our central character, to the hero, whether he'll live, whether he'll die, whether she will go on a worldwide trip or whatever, whether ghosts will maul her, whatever you're looking at. That is the focus of our attention. Places exist, but they exist to bring to fruition all the wonderful complexities of this character. Now, Buell is suggesting we have to correct that. We have to correct that by paying attention to the specificities of the place without, in some senses, without the human characters that inhabit it. In other words, he thinks there is too much emphasis placed on the cultural and intellectual autonomy of human beings, both within texts and outside texts. In fact, that's why we're interested in the human characters, and we and we really treat places as fairly inert backdrops to what those characters are doing and their lives. He wants us to have a corrective to that particular lens. Instead, he wants us to think of what is the specific relation between, let's say, that kind of space and the characters who live there and live in a way that is appropriate to that kind of space. In other words, what is the role of that space in the production of the character, the way the character behaves, the way the character talks, in fact, the way in which the story is transmitted to us. Remember when we read McInnes, we had this idea of this very energetic style in which we trace jazz, we trace contemporary London slangs, etc., etc. In other words, we said, oh, McInnes has a fairly punchy, absorbing style that presents to us all the cultural life of a particular historical moment. Now, Buell is asking us to step back and think of, okay, so there's cultural life and cultural resources in McInnes' style of the novel, but what about the place he's writing about? Is that particular style of the novel, what is the correspondences between that and the particular place, that is to say London, from within which it rises? So, the first, and in these ways, he's interrogating the ideas of Williams and Jameson. He's suggesting it's all very well and indeed necessary to think about the relationship between history, culture, communities, individuals. But what is the relationship of the ground that they inhabit and their lives? And indeed, as readers, how we receive them. So, place is something authors find easier to name and praise rather than to present. And he warns us about this. This is a map. I'll come to the whole idea of maps in a bit. He warns us that quite often, and this is your first quote in your handout, the sense of place, what he's calling place sense, for example, we routinely describe McInnes as a London novelist, as a novelist of London. So there's a very enhanced sense of him being associated with a particular space or place. For place sense may actually connect us with actual environments in such a way as to insulate us, this is the first quotation on your handout, insulate us from critical apprehensions of them so that they instill a form of amnesia that allows us to forget our separateness and the world's indifference. This is what comes up again and again in Buell. So for what he's suggesting is place is all around us, places in all the texts we read, places in the present in the music we listen to, and the films we look at, and the plays we go to. But quite often, they're represented in such a way that they make us forget, rather than make us remember, make us forget our actual lived relationship with a particular space. They give us an illusion or an illusory version of how people's lives are. And that particular illusion has to do with an excess or an excessive emphasis on the cultural life of human beings and a corresponding underwriting or a misunderstanding of the relationship of human beings, their lives, and the spaces they inhabit. So culture is all very well, but somehow for Buell, we have to integrate the notion of a particular lived space within that idea of culture. So, as I say, in Jameson and Williams, we had this enhanced notion of cultural life and historical lives. Buell is saying we have to integrate a notion of spatial life within that idea to really make it appropriate for any kind of representation or analysis. Now, obviously, if you look at this map, or this picture, it's very, very different to that one, okay? So just look at that picture and then think of this one. Again, really talking about the same space, a particular portion of central London, but in a different idiom, right? What is that idiom? When you look at that and you go back to the earlier picture, how do you react? In what way are they different, do you think? Emotionally, how do you react to that and the map? How does that make you feel? Sorry?
There's no relationship.
There is no relationship between what and what?
Between us and the map.
Between us and the map, okay. responses to that? When you look at it, I mean, if you know, one way of looking at that is, okay, if, you know, there's no relationship between me and the map, but if I'm trying to find a bar in London, you know what am I going to do? Right. It doesn't evoke anything. Is that how? Yes.
If you have other things, other experiences you can bring to that.
Right.
You have memories
of places. Okay. Okay. So two very important terms here: evocation and memory. Okay. Now, does this help? Does this picture help in evoking memory of whatever kind? Not about London, obviously. All of you will have various memories of, you know, various kinds of spaces. Is that a closer or better way of evoking memory than the map? Or does it evoke different kinds of memory? What kind of memories does that evoke?
Getting lost.
Getting lost, yes. Not a very good memory at all. Yes, getting lost. What about the earlier picture? You are, or the earlier picture? That's what.
Siesta.
Okay. So not getting lost, a different kind of restful emotion. Is that consistent? I mean, what does that make? I mean, personally, when I look at it, it makes me think, oh, early mornings, get time to get to work. So that's not very nice either. But yeah, what do you think? No, they do. Go on, what do you think?
That central place where you can be in,
right,
in the street, whereas the map is just simply like just a vision of it.
Excellent. So three different very good terms. What you raise is the idea of inhabitation, living in a space. You gave the idea of an evocative space, that is to say an emotional space. And you were talking about the idea of memory. So different representation of spaces you can already see, although they're all about one place, notionally London. These two pictures give us a three very different entry points into how you feel about them. One picture gives you a notion of evocative memories, of notions of inhabitation or living, or that place being livable. And the idea of memories being attached to that place. It's easier to feel that way when you look at the representation. This has a different set of emotions altogether, feelings of orientation slash disorientation, getting lost, the feelings of being distant from a place. You can't really, it's hard to imagine a livable space there. It's hard to imagine where, although you can locate perhaps where you would live or where you do live or where you could live, it's hard to get that evocative feeling about, yes, I want to live here. There's some place I can inhabit, etc. So what I'm getting at is place representation, both visually and we'll come to textual representation in a bit, offers us different grids of emotion and different feelings about that particular kind of space or place it is representing. There's one more, for example, if you take that one step beyond, again, it's the same, it's a photograph of the same space, central London. Now, what is different to even the earlier map there that you saw here? What is different, how is this different from the earlier map? Sorry? There is a lack of those, you know, funny little cartoons that says Hyde Park is here or X is here, etc. So there's a lack of details. There's a different set of details. Where is this taken from? Yeah. In other words, it's taken from the air, right? So that thing that we are talking about, distancing that you just mentioned, it may inhabitation. It's even harder to think of this space in terms of inhabitation and actually occupying that space, partly because the lens is so far up the sky and the sense of the space is already so distant. It makes us very, very difficult for us as viewers to think of that place as even a space where people live, let alone you. But the fact that there's a large and sprawling human presence there, and human and non-human presence there, that is difficult to imagine comparatively speaking, than the first picture that we saw, which was at a ground level, which was taken at a certain time of the day, which evokes, it has certain structures in it, such as the pub and the building, and it evokes and triggers off certain sets of response that this doesn't do. It sets off a different, totally different kind of emotional responses, responses of that have to do with distance, responses that have to do with a rational gridding of where people live. Look at how London, on the right-hand side there, reveals to you, as it doesn't when you're on the ground, as rigidly ordered blocks. Yeah? Look at how the map, the very neat squares. It's a gridded space. It's a well-planned, well-ordered, gridded space, not something you associate with London when you walk through it. Certainly not something you associate with London when you read McInnes, right? The text gives us a very different notion of space. Napoli, think of in all its kind of chaotic splendor. That is not what we see here. So, in other words, what we have are representations of space, all three pictures look at the same kind, same unit, that is to say central London, but they give us, they situate us at different points in our emotional thermometer, if you like, as far as that place is concerned. We are very close, we feel cozy and comforted by one, and gradually we move away. The second map you saw was kind of halfway. You know, you see, okay, you're still at ground level, you're still looking at, you know, recognizable landmarks, they still have cute little captions on them. This has none of that. You're in the position of a pilot of a surveillance plane, or if you're really twisted, of a bomber about to bomb London, right? So that's where you are. And that is a completely different set of representation. What Buell is trying to make us think is how space reaches us, how we think of space, how we locate space, how we think of what our relationship to our inhabited space is, depends on the kinds of representation that are available to us. And he's suggesting that not enough is paid attention to what he calls the world's indifference. The fact that space, material space, actually doesn't give a shit about what happens to us, right? It's indifferent to human emotions, habitations, not in a hostile way, but simply as in an autonomous way. In other words, the fields, the trees, the buildings, etc. Imagine, you know, in a kind of 1950s sci-fi way, a hydrogen bomb goes off there. What happens to you and me? We don't exist. But the buildings do, right? The cockroaches do. In some ways, the material space does without us. It goes on. It carries on. Not enough, Buell is saying, not enough attention is paid to that fact of the essential materiality of space that goes on without us. Okay, and this is, as you can recognize, this is a kind of old trope coming down right to us from someone like, you know, Keats writing in the early 19th century about the essential indifference of what he called nature then, for example. The fact that, you know, you eulogize nature, but there you forget to see that it's red in tooth and claw. And it doesn't really care about what happens to human beings. This is a very old trope. Buell is extending that trope to our idea of contemporary world. What do we have to do? He suggests we have to pay more attention of how spaces exist and how they carry on perfectly well, without us. In other words, how they have an autonomous life outside culture. So he thinks too much is spoken of in terms of culture and history. To understand our real relationship, we have to make a bow, we have to make concession to the fact that culture and history are both, that is to say, but the culture and history, if you think of it, they're both artificial or human. Humans make culture, humans make history, is the normative notion that we grow up with. We don't usually talk about, for example, the well-developed culture of red ants or of the pine trees. We associate culture with human activity. He wants to correct that by lessening our focus on the relationship between culture and history and think more of the relationship between non-human spaces and culture and history. Okay? So all three spaces are ways of representation in some ways, regulate our emotional responses to that, and he's trying to make us think of ways in which we can integrate the idea of the world's separateness from us to some extent. Okay? Because too much and too often we take space for granted. We represent it as if it is nothing but a kind of theater in which we can play out our emotions and our concerns. Space, Buell is suggesting, has a life of its own, and that life doesn't necessarily coincide with ours. What happens when we look at that particular, when we integrate that kind of consciousness in our writing? Should we do it? Can we do it? So, that is the problem in front of us. Now, the second part of Buell's argument has to do with what three of you just said, that is to say the relationship between history, memory, and space, and that is pretty much what we have just discussed. If you just contrast the last two visuals with this one, immediately you sense the difference, right? And it's generally a positive difference. So, what do you feel about this one, in contrast to the two maps that we saw? Again, just look at it without any critical file. Just plain. These are pictures I've presented in front of you. Just have a look. Immediately, what's your response? Fun. It allows for play and fun. Okay. What else? Even amongst those of you who are not football fans. Yeah, go on.
It means something.
Such as what? Okay.
You can make something that means something to you out of that.
Yeah. Okay, what story would you make out of that? Not to put you on spot, obviously, but just what did you feel when you saw that?
Well, it's like, it's innocence.
There's a sense of innocence going back to the idea of play. Yeah.
And
although, obviously, little boys can be perfect beasts. So,
yeah.
So you know.
Right. Within the children, and they have their own rules and their own values, and they obey them rather than what
they've learned. In other words, it's a little community,
yeah,
with its own rules and the way they play, the way they fight, etc., etc. In other words, what you hit on is it's a crucial factor in the second layer of Buell's argument, the relationship between stories and spaces, right? Everything that you just mentioned, the idea of a community, the idea of rules, the idea of emotions, et cetera, are crucial ingredients of human stories. Okay? And that story can only be told in this particular space, not in the space on Google Earth where you had London spread out below you. It's impossible to tell that story. Now, think of that relationship between why stories can be told within certain spaces. In other words, this story has a particular picture of its own. This picture has another way around, particular story of its own. And it's easier for us to narrate a story or attach a totally fictive. We don't know what the lives of these people are, obviously. But we can narrate a version of what we might call history simply because this space, this particular space is there. Okay? So if history is a narrative or a set of stories, testifiable and otherwise, but a set of narratives nonetheless, why is it that we need a certain kind of space to tell a certain kind of history? In other words, why and how, this is Buell's next step in Buell's argument, what is the relationship between certain kinds of stories and certain kinds of spaces? Okay, we've accepted, we integrate space as an autonomous entity into our idea of culture and history. What is that specific relationship? For example, going back to this particular story, what kind of story would you tell? Would it be a kind of fun story? Would it be a crime thriller? Would it be, I don't know. They kept the girl out and the background. So what kind of story would you say?
Alienation.
And yeah, and it's she's kind of faded. Gender discrimination. Well, what kind of story
she's
would you tell?
A doll.
So would you write an angry story about
yes.
it? Okay. So you have we have an angry realist story about the little girl carrying a dog, slightly blurred, going away on this foggy morning in this particular city. That's one style of telling this. Clearly, there's a hit on your hands here. But what other kinds of so there's a sense of, in other words, there's a sense of social protest, anger, etc., that you can integrate from this, or can take from this story. What else can you do? What kind of story would you write amongst budding writers? Yes.
Well, they look like they're wearing school uniforms.
Yeah. Very good.
And there's a real sense of period because, and I don't know, in London I don't see kids playing the street anymore.
Absolutely.
So it's kind of nice privilege.
Okay. So what would the story you would write would be? Okay, so it'll be excellent. I wait to see this story. Probably the boy who's just played that pass through out on the wing. But anyway, it'll be a kind of period story about a vanished community at a particular point in time. As you say, you don't see this particular community. So it'll be, in other words, not really as angry as Katia's, perhaps sort of more nostalgic, gentler tone, which could also be a very good story, and I'm sure will be, you know, in the Christmas top 20 or whatever it is. So in other words, what Buell is trying to make us think about is the relationship between styles you adopt. Immediately we notice the two different styles you adopted. You had a really angry tone in the story coming through. You had a far different tone of the story that you would tell. So the relationship between styles of narrative and the places on which those narratives are grounded, right? We had talked about Jameson and Williams as they surveyed styles that come out of particular historical period. Buell is asking us to think about styles that come out of a particular grounding of a story. Okay? So this story can be told in a variety of ways, obviously, but the styles that which you adopt, in addition to all the cultural resources that you have as educated writers, will be determined to a large extent by the ground from which that narrative arises, and, most importantly, not to forget, the ground that you inhabit at a particular point in time as a writer. So the ground that you inhabit as a potential writer is different from Katia's, obviously. Although you're sharing the space at the moment, your biographical details will be different to hers, and the grounds that you have walked on and lived in will, to some senses, determine the style that you have adopted. That is what Buell is asking us to think about. Okay, when you sit down to write a story or make a film or make a piece of music, you normally think of, you know, what will I do? I've read this or I know this. I'll use some of this particular style to say this particular story that arises from within me. Yeah, that's normally how you sit down. Or if it's a collaborative effort, you put all your heads together and say, okay, each of us have this kind of idea about this piece of music or this piece of writing. That is what goes into the writing. What also goes into the writing is the ground that you're inhabiting, the space that you're inhabiting, and the space that you're representing. Okay? That is what Buell is trying to nudge us towards. The styles we adopt may not consciously do this, but the styles have a correlation between where you've lived, how you've lived, and the spaces that you're writing about and representing. Okay, so the idea of history as a storytelling, history as a narrative, and the kind of stories that are being told are determined by the spaces from which those stories arise and the spaces inhabited by you as producers of stories, but also readers as consumers of stories. Okay, that determines what style the stories are told in and how they are received. So the beginning of your second handout says, thus the site of virtually every landmark, no matter how insignificant, look at these landmarks, they're not nothing special about them. It may seem to the foreign visitor passing through the desert brings emotional satisfaction. This observation would apply also to long-established settler cultures, etc. He compares North American settler cultures to established cultures there. So the link between emotional response, stories, and spaces, that is where we're getting at with Buell. And you'll have noticed in Buell's writing, most of the examples he takes are, I've deliberately not taken the same example. The most examples he takes are from North American wilderness narratives about nature, etc., and which is obviously all very true and applicable. I've deliberately focused, partly because of because we used McInnes, but I've deliberately focused on representations of city inhabited space to see whether his argument works. So far we've looked at visual representations of cities and lived spaces. And so far we've had these propositions thrown at us. One, that the idea of an autonomous space, a non-human space, is important and it's necessary to integrate that idea within our history of culture and community. The second point is that idea of a an autonomous space, that is to say a space that goes on existing before and after human lives, have an intricate connection with the way that stories are told, okay? Whatever those stories might be, whatever way those texts go. Now, we looked at visual representations. Again, we come back to London. Again, because of McInnes, I'm not a card carrier for London, so I'm just taking these examples because that's what you've read in this unit so far. Now, there's three moments in time. I'm going to look at three texts to close today's discussion. Three moments in time and three kinds of representations of the city. Okay? This, as you can see, it's dated just over two centuries ago, and this is a familiar poem, or will be familiar to some of us. Any ideas? Very good. William Wordsworth writing about really an early morning view of London. Now, actually, since you recognize this story, can I have a brave volunteer to read the poetry? I'll read it otherwise, but I just want to listen to how you read this particular poem. Volunteers? Please. A round of applause, please. That's an excellent performance. Now, what you capture brilliantly there is the rhythm of the text. And what I want you to think of is how that rhythm is perfectly suited to the physical space it's describing. That is to say, an early morning scene in London where, actually, as the poet says, all that mighty heart is lying still. So the cadence of the poem, the cadence of the meters, the arrangement of the verse and the verse form, and if you read it aloud, immediately captures first the idea of a mighty heart of the city lying still, and your own relationship to it. It's like breathing an early morning air when you've just got up and you're looking at the city. That's what the poem is getting at. That's why those pauses, those commas, and how the lines run on. So what Buell is trying to, and this is your final point really, in terms of the representative possibilities and the limits of representation, is to show how texts can, not just the subject of the text, but the texture of the writing or the photograph or the film, how they can get close to really the existence of your physical body. That is to say, you've woken up in the morning, you're looking at London, nobody else has got up, you're breathing slowly in the morning as you do when you've just got up, and you're looking at the city, and you feel the slowness and slumber of the city is at one with your lived life. The day hasn't started, you haven't packed your bags, you're not running to catch the hideous pink bus to campus. What you're doing is pausing to catch your breath. And that pause, when you catch your breath, is corresponding exactly with the space that you have in front of you. Where human beings live, but none of them are visible at this moment. If you look at the images there, the ships, towers, domes, theaters, they're structures, they're physical structures that are lying at rest. And you, momentarily, before the madness of the day and the eating your cereal, etc., takes over, you momentarily are at one with it. So what do you have here, and normally when we read this poem, obviously, you know, we analyze its textual borrowings, we look at Wordsworth's biography, we look at all kinds of things, except for the specific place that he's writing about, that is to say London. London here is not so much a background against which the poet's voice is, you know, holding forth. It is actually what produces that particular cadence and that particular tone. So the relationship between the style of the poem, I'll give you another example. At a different point in history, again, you'll recognize this, some of us. Any ideas?
Dickens,
excellent. Opening of Bleak House, the second paragraph from the novel, right? Immediately note how the texture of the, partly because of the, you know, the formal difference and the generic differences between a poem and a novel, immediately note the different rhythm. Another volunteer for a portion of Dickens? Go on, don't be shy. You see how brilliantly it can be done. Yeah, it's all right. You can read it in a foggy voice. That's the whole. Volunteers, quick. Running out of time, 10 minutes. Ah, nobody wants to read Dickens. Everyone wants to read Wordsworth. There's a problem. Okay. Fog everywhere. Fog up the river where it flows among the green eights and the meadows. Fog down the river where it rolls deified among the tears of shipping and the waterside pollutions of a great and dirty city. Fog on the Essex marshes. Fog on the Kentish heights. Fog creeping into the cabooses of the collier brigs, etc., etc., etc. Chance people on the look at the human figures here. Chance people on the bridges peeping over the parapets into a nether sky of fog with fog all around them as if they were up in a balloon and hanging in the misty clouds. All that, you know, fog, 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 fog. And what you have here is a diminished humanity completely enveloped by an atmospheric presence of the fog that defines. We don't know who they are. We don't know whether they can see each other. Their particular relationship and the relationship of you with the passage. By the time you read through that staccato punctuation of short sentences, you're struggling to see what this passage is giving us. You know, you can kind of make out the cabin. You kind of make out the apprentice boy. You can't really see. There are no details of it. There's no sign of what they look like, what they're talking about, etc., etc. There's a permeation of... The novel is all about looking. As a reader, you're looking at the scene, but it's saying that you actually, what you're seeing, you cannot actually see what you're looking at. So it's about a visuality that doesn't obtain. You cannot look at what you're looking at. It is foggy. Momentarily, you're in there just as these characters are. Now, what Dickens has done there, just like Wordsworth, is to texture his writing in a particular way that produces not just the story that he's telling, but a particular kind of consciousness in his readers, in himself, and in the, again, like the London of the previous example, a particular space that conditions all those responses. It's a history, it's a story, it's a narrative that is produced. It's not telling you, fog is here, not a background. It's a primary feature that has, in some senses, taken over and enveloped human culture. Those figures there, if we think about humans as cultural beings, are here produced and conditioned by fog, okay? An environmental phenomenon. Your last point, we've got about 5 minutes. Your final quotation, and this is a familiar one from McInnes, of course. Again, look at how the rhythm, all these things that you see, friends, the gardens, the cloud kisses, that is to say the 60s buildings, the port life down at Thames, all of which heighten the fact all these things are doing perfectly okay without a description of a human character in them. Momentarily, it conditions McInnes and you as readers, and in fact, the absolute beginners who inhabit the novel, in their proper relationship and somewhat diminished relationship with the spaces they inhabit. Normally, when you look at, as I was saying, when you look at a novel, you look at the characters being the main thing in the novel. Really, it's their stories, their lives, etc., that we're interested in. But the fact that each of them are conditioned by the space they inhabit, these are the moments of the text that are textured and they mimic the space that the characters inhabit. These are the moments that give us that sense of partial autonomy of space outside culture. What Buell is suggesting is unless we can accept that fact, unless we can accept the fact that trees, fog, cities, countryside, whatever it is, buildings, if you like, have lives of their own that exceed in some way ours. They're not backdrops against which our lives are lived. To the contrary, they produce the kinds of life we live, and crucially, the stories about those lives we can tell each other. That is what Buell is getting us. The stories we tell about each other, the novels, etc., but also in your day-to-day conversation, in everything you do as cultural beings, etc., that is produced by the buildings, the space, the cities, the countries, etc., the physical, material space that you live in. That is and what is the relationship between those spaces and the particular styles? That is what we have to think of, in addition to everything that Jameson and Williams told us, to arrive at a properly conceived notion of material culture and the relationship between that and cultural styles. So take this away with you, the relationship between the materiality of culture and the styles of the various narratives. And next time, you know, when you're in a club at 2 a.m, think how that will influence the stories you tell about each other in your lives. Okay, end of unit. Next week is reading week, obviously. You don't have a class. Week 7, you start your next unit, the lectures for which will be given by Dr. Rashmi Varma. So expect to see all of you there.